This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the many controversial parts of President Clinton's economic program involves increasing the taxes on Social Security benefits. This would affect individuals with incomes over $25,000 and couples with incomes over $32,000. My guest, Philip Longman, has been reporting on entitlement programs for about a decade. He thinks President Clinton is taking a few baby steps in the right direction, but what's really needed is a total overhaul of all entitlement programs. Longman says the Social Security system no longer expresses the ideals behind its creation. The system now favors the privileged. And if we continue at the rate we're going, it will be bankrupt in 17 years. Longman is the author of a 1987 book about why the Social Security system is heading toward financial disaster called Born to Pay. He's writing a new book about entitlements. To help get a perspective on Social Security, I asked Longman how much of the federal budget is spent on it.
Well, it depends how you measure it, but it cruises along at about 5% of the gross national product. Total spending on the elderly now accounts for 60% of all social spending. Social Security, of course, has some programs that benefit young people, such as the disability component of Social Security. But it's a major source of government spending. Actually, about three-quarters of the total growth in the deficit results from Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and federal pensions. The current proposals that Clinton has out only address the real problems of entitlements at the margins. He has some highly symbolic sacrifices that he asks, but nothing that really puts these programs on a sound footing for the next century.
Now, if I understand your writing correctly, you're not proposing that we do away with Social Security for retirees. You just want to see it reformed so that Social Security is distributed in a more equitable way.
Well, I think we have to make it closer to what it was originally intended to be, which is a social insurance program against the very real possibility that any of us may become poor in old age. Unfortunately, it has over the years evolved into something quite different than that. Currently, Social Security and Medicare together are distributing about $75 billion a year to people who earn more than $50,000 a year. And, of course, it's raising that money largely through, or exclusively through, a payroll tax on younger workers that hits the poor hardest. Again, even if we didn't need this money for investments in the future, this would simply be an unfair and untenable income redistribution system.
Now, I think most of us think of Social Security like this. During our working years, we put in a certain amount of money. Then when we retire, we get that money back, and that money sustains us in our retirement years. And it's upsetting to think that the government's going to, like, change the rules on us, and that when we retire, we're going to make less than what we expected, or less than what we were promised.
Well, you've hit the nail right on the head. I mean, that is the political problem with Social Security, is that most people believe that, and they believe it for a good reason. The Social Security Administration for the last 50 years has been telling people that. So you can't really blame the American people for believing it. But unfortunately, it's convenient as it is to believe it, it's just not true. People retiring today can look forward to, on average, about a $32,000 a year windfall profit. That is, if you take the total amount of contributions that they've made to Social Security on average over their working lives, you adjust it for inflation. And that's very important because a lot of people don't realize this. You adjust it for inflation so that the dollars you're counting today are the same as the dollars you might be counting in 1955 or so. It still comes out that the average retiree today, just in the Social Security program, is getting back about two and a half times what he paid in. Or put another way, he'll get back in the first 10 years of his retirement what he paid in, yet the life tables tell us on average they'll live 20 years. Then, of course, that doesn't even count the really extraordinary rates of return that are available under Medicare, which have been estimated by the government to be on the order of 12 times the benefit being returned to today's recipient in comparison to what they paid into the system.
I don't really understand what the correlation is between the money that you pay in during your working years and the money you get back when you retire.
Well, there is no correlation. inflation. It's politically determined. Another very common myth about Social Security is that the government somehow keeps an account or even keeps track of the money that you give to them over the years, and that money sits in a little pot and earns interest, and then when you retire, you make a claim on that. In reality, the money that the government collects from workers each month goes that same month towards one of two purposes nowadays, either to pay for the benefits of current recipients or to help underwrite the national debt. But in neither case is anything being set aside to pay for future benefits, contrary to a lot of myths about there being a surplus in the Social Security system. And so anyway, the system is as they say, a pay-as-you-go system. The money you pay into it is spent as you pay into it. And so when you reach retirement age, it isn't there anymore.
If you worked for a fairly low income throughout your working years, when you retire, will you get significantly less in Social Security than somebody who got a lot of money in their paycheck during their working years?
The program pays the highest benefit to those least in need. In other words, the more money you have, the bigger your benefit. The less money you earned over your lifetime, the less Social Security you'll get. It's another crazy aspect of the system.
I guess there's two different ways to look at what is most equitable. One is that the people who put in the most money to the system should get the most out of it. The other way to look at it is the people who need the money the most should get the most money.
Well, that's right. But I don't really understand why when the system... I mean, you have to take account for the fact that the promises were made, that people were told that they were pre-funding their retirement by these kind of contributions, and that obviously is politically important. It's morally important, and nobody's suggesting that Social Security benefits simply be cut. But what we are suggesting is, in the current climate, that perhaps it would be appropriate for people to expect to get no more back from Social Security than they paid in, plus interest. And that would be really to hold them to the standard of social insurance. Remember that if you're going to think of the Social Security system as a insurance system, it's one that's gone amok. It's one that's paying far more in benefits than it collected in contributions. So if we're going to think of it only as a insurance system, it's time to cut benefits across the board dramatically. But, of course, it isn't an insurance system, and that's not the appropriate thing to do.
The Social Security system was started under the Roosevelt administration in 1935. Were there certain New Deal assumptions that you think are no longer true in the 1990s?
Yes. Actually, it's not the assumptions that were made in the 1930s so much as the assumptions that were made in the 1970s and 60s, when the Social Security program was dramatically expanded. And those assumptions were that the baby boom that was going on at that time would continue forever, that there would be ever higher birth rates in the United States, so that you'd have ever more people paying into the system, and probably more profoundly, that the next generation would grow up to be many, many times more affluent than the current generation. You probably remember some of the atmosphere of the early 1970s, but this was a time when economists testified before Congress and seriously estimated that within 20 years the American workforce would be working an average of 20 hours a week and making four or five times the average wage of workers in 1970. Well, I mean, it would have been nice if it was true, but it didn't happen. Unfortunately, they structured the financing of Social Security and many other entitlements as if it were going to happen. And that is the key policy error that was made that is causing all these problems with our entitlement programs right now. Our kids, there's fewer kids than we thought there were going to be because birth rates have been declining until very recently. And of course, they are not anywhere near as affluent as we might have hoped. The poverty rate now among children is 1 out of 5. Children are now the poorest age group in our society, and it's just nuts to bank the future of the country's finances on the ability of this huge poverty population to grow up to be richer than we are, despite all the handicaps we're placing in their way.
At what point does the United States start to change demographically in a way significant enough to really change the Social Security system, the ability of the Social Security system to support itself?
Well, the really tough years start in 2010, because that's when the baby boom generation starts moving into old age in a big way. And immediately the system begins running huge deficits. The amount of payroll taxes needed to cover Social Security escalate dramatically. So those are the tough years. I mean, one of the really scary things about right now is that demographically, this should be the best of times for the United States. Right now, we have what might be called the middle aging of America going on. That is, the fastest growing age group in America now is the cohorts in their 40s and 50s. That's because of the aging of the baby boom generation into that time of life. And those are the years when people typically earn their highest salaries and pay the most in taxes and are the most productive. So right now, you couldn't ask for the country's demographics to be any more favorable, and yet look at these huge deficits. That gives you some kind of hint of what's coming in the next century when all these trends are thrown into reverse.
So you think unless we reform the Social Security system that there's no way it's going to be able to support itself?
No, not without imposing impossible burdens on the next generation. I mean, it's always theoretically possible to raise payroll taxes up to the 50% of payroll that the Social Security Administration projects will ultimately be needed. But I think in the real world, our kids won't stand for that. They'll tell us where to go. I think we've been talking a lot about Social Security, but in many ways, healthcare is even a deeper problem. Right now, we're not spending as much on Medicare as we are on Social Security, but because of the just really dramatic trends in the cost of healthcare, that are, of course, driven by the aging of the population, it really, and if you take a not-so-long view into the future, it's healthcare that is the thing that we really ought to be concentrating on.
My guest is journalist Philip Longman, author of the 1987 book Born to Pay and a forthcoming book about entitlements. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Philip Longman is my guest. Well, Hillary Clinton is looking into reforming the whole healthcare system. What are some of the problems you see that you think really need to be addressed?
Well, again, we have to analyze what is causing the problem. And the two big trends are working in concert to cause this incredible escalation in healthcare costs. One is the aging of the population. As we get older, we all need more healthcare, so an aging population has a greater demand for healthcare, dramatically greater demand. The other is this relentless increase in the utilization of high technology, much of which has very dubious actual medical benefits, but which is nonetheless very, very expensive. And right now, we just have no way to put a brake on that, and we don't budget for healthcare. We don't sit down and figure out our priorities as far as what kind of health care we want and how we want it delivered and when in our lives we want it delivered.
Let me stop you there. The when in our lives we want it delivered, what's the issue there?
Well, right now we have a system of publicly financed health care that provides almost all of its benefits to people at the end of their lives and very little, if any, benefit to people at the beginning of their lives. And this is creates a perverse world because here, after all, it's as if before you were born, God or whoever was in charge came to you and said, well, there's a certain amount of health care we're going to allocate to you over your lifetime. Now, we want you to decide before you're born, when do you want it? Do you want it when you're young, when you're old, when you're in the middle? You know, you tell us. And I think most of us, if we were in that situation, would say, well, the thing I want is that I want to maximize my chances of getting to be old. That's what amounts to me. And once I have achieved a ripe old age, then I'm increasingly less interested in spending resources that only improve my life expectancy for a matter of days or weeks. And unfortunately, the system we now have really is, in essence, a system like that. A third of the Medicare dollars that we spend in this country, which, of course, go exclusively to the population over 65, a third of those dollars go to people who die within a year. And as we all know, or most of us know from personal experience with dying relatives, that there's an enormous amount of money that's spent in the last several days of people's lives, very typically, and in ways that are just impossible to control. And it's that aspect of our healthcare spending that we have to tackle. And it's very tough, and it forces our politics to confront all kinds of choices and issues that we're not accustomed to dealing with in a public forum. But it has to be done, because this is what's driving the cost of healthcare so much, and especially will be driving it in the next century, as we have this explosion in the population over 65.
Do you find that it's very difficult to talk about Medicare reform or Social Security reform without sounding like you're attacking the elderly or, you know, resenting the elderly?
Well, I do find it difficult, and I hope I haven't said it that way. Sometimes we use shorthand for describing certain classes of people. I don't see this as essentially an issue between the old and the young. I see it as essentially as an issue of how we allocate resources to ourselves over our lifetimes. And I apologize to anybody if I have sounded as if I were attempting to blame the problems of the world on today's senior citizens, because I am not at all. In fact, it's my generation that is causing most of this problem in the long run.
How so?
Well, we're the ones that are the boom. We are the population bulge that is going to swell the ranks of the elderly in the next century. And it's on us to minimize the burden that we're going to present to the few children that are behind us. But we can't. The problem is, the political problem right now is that you can't bring up the subject of Social Security reform or Medicare reform or health care reform in the long run without immediately bumping into to the American Association of Retired Persons and the current gray lobby and getting into a big argument with them about current benefits and who won World War II and all the rest of this stuff. And I would very much like to avoid that argument and raise this whole discussion to a higher plane. But unfortunately, at least for the time that I've been working this issue, which is about 10 years now, there's been a kind of gag rule out there that you do not question the long-term future of Social Security. If you do, you're immediately stereotyped as some kind of right-wing cretin. And I think all this is changing very rapidly now. I think thoughtful people around Clinton and in social policy circles in general now understand these issues a lot better than they did 10 years ago, and the climate of opinion is changing rapidly. But it's very dangerous and very difficult to talk about these subjects without, as you say, sounding like a granny basher.
Well, I think what you're trying to encourage us to do is to view entitlements as a whole, and instead of chipping away at this part of Social Security and changing the tax on that part, to just kind of rethink the whole thing?
Yes, rethink our entire social welfare state. And to kind of come up with reasons or criteria for how we allocate resources. Do we allocate resources merely on the basis of one's birthday, or do we allocate resources on the basis of some kind of need, medical, financial, otherwise? And unfortunately, during the age of the New Deal, you know, America was coming out of a kind of a frontier society, and people had a very individualistic ethics was still dominant, and it was very hard for people to accept benefits from the government in those days. There was a great stigma attached to it, and they saw it as relief. And so huge myths were built up by social policy activists to try and ease the indignity of receiving social benefits for people. And this is what explains the jargon that surrounds Social Security, the jargon of taxes being contributions and all the insurance parlance. But that it may have served a purpose in its day, but today it's just getting in the way. I mean, today we need to strip past all the rhetoric and just look at the real peas under the shells and see where is the money actually going, who's benefiting it, does it make any sense? And to try and do that in as value-neutral way as we can.
I know that you think that Social Security is inequitably distributed, that people who have a lot of money end up getting more money than those who really need the money. Do you have any statistics handy about how the money, for instance, was distributed in 1992? Who got what?
Who got what? Let's see. For Social Security program in itself, spent $55 billion last year conveying benefits to families that had income over $50,000 a year. Now, just to put that in perspective, if we took $10 billion and applied it specifically to the problem of eliminating totally poverty among the elderly, $10 billion would do it. If you took $10 billion and targeted it at the remaining elderly population that is poor, that would be enough to lift every one of them above the poverty line. And yet we spent five times that much money, $55 billion, paying Social Security benefits to people who typically use them for paying for their green fees and traveling to tropical ports of call and tooting around the country in an RV with a bumper sticker that says we're outspending our children's inheritance. There's just no reason to be spending that kind of money on people that don't need it, not in the current context.
Are you very worried about your future, by the way? What will happen to you when you retire?
Well, yes, and I wish that the government would put people on notice that they need to be saving a lot more for their retirement than most people are. Most people should be putting away at least 10% of their income towards retirement, and they're not, and they're being lulled into a sense of false confidence by the gag rule that prohibits public discussion of the long-term prospects for Social Security. So, yeah, I'm worried, and so should the rest of you.
Well, thanks for talking with us.
Okay.
Philip Longman is the politics and public policy editor of Florida Trend magazine and the author of the 1987 book on the Social Security system, Born to Pay. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.